Hello everyone, this is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today the digest format of CQ Magazine for June 2011. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard S. Mawson, amateur call W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage A&M System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, one word, handyham@courage.org. The Handyham website is www.handyham.org. We always spell Handyham, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word. Let's start off today with ham radio news. First, an announcement. Young Ham of the Year nominations are due by June 30th of this year. Do you know a young ham who has done something special related to ham radio? The Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award, sponsored by CQ, honors one radio amateur 18 or younger each year who has made a significant contribution to society through amateur radio. Nominations for the 2011 award must be received by June 30. Full details and nominating forms are available online at www.arnewsline.org. That's www.arnewsline.org. Mail nominations to Young Ham of the Year Award, care of Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, CA 91350. Cost estimate for ARRL Steady Bill, $1 million. The Nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that conducting the studies mandated by S-191, the Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Enhancement Act of 2011, would cost taxpayers approximately $1 million in 2012, if passed and signed into law. The bill, which is being heavily promoted by the ARRL, would direct the Department of Homeland Security to study the uses and capabilities of the amateur radio service during and after a disaster or emergency, and would require the department's inspector general to additionally report on the cost of grant programs administered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the extent to which these programs overlap with each other. The CBO analysis was requested by the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. On a slightly different note, penny postcard, up another penny. Some of our readers may recall that the cost of mailing a postcard was just one penny. You know, folks, I remember that. What does that tell you, huh? Well, as of April 17, it costs one penny more to mail a postcard. While rates on first-class letters did not change, the postcard rate increased from 28 cents to 29. In case you haven't used them lately, hi, hi. Obviously, this affects any hams mailing QSL cards directly within the United States. Special call sign for Royal Wedding. If you worked any stations in the United Kingdom with GR, MR, or 2R prefixes during the late April or early May, then you were part of the celebration of the wedding of Prince William and Catherine Middleton. The special call sign prefixes were authorized by the British government at the request of the Radio Society of Great Britain to be used between April 29th, the date of the royal wedding, and May 9. William II in line to the British throne after his father, Prince Charles. Federal Communications Commission launches a new beta website. The FCC has opened access to its new beta website, the first major overhaul of the agency's website in a decade. Once you get past all the buzzwords in the announcement about it, now this is a parenthesized commentary, architected with a more intuitive user experience, the reimagined FCC.gov is proof that .govs can look, feel, and run like .coms. End parenthesis. You'll find some interesting features, including blogs by commission staffers and a very cool, quoting, spectrum dashboard, close quote, that lets you search for the allocations of various services or browse by frequency. Unfortunately, the architects of the new site appeared to believe the radio spectrum begins at 225 megahertz, and we haven't been able to figure out how to search for amateur allocations, even though they're listed on the chart. Check it out yourself at http://beta.fcc.gov/. Several prominent amateurs, silent keys. Four prominent hams became silent keys in late March and early April. On March 27, Paul Barron, called W3KAS, died from complications of lung cancer, according to the ARRL letter. Barron was one of the fathers of the Internet and of packet radio. He came up with the idea of packet switching, in which data to be transmitted is broken up into small packages, sent over sometimes varying routes, and reassembled at its destination. The following day, the ARRL newsletter reports Mike Koss, K-O-S-S, amateur called W9SU, owner of Industrial Communications Engineers, ICE, passed away suddenly after collapsing on his workshop floor. ICE, well known among hams as a manufacturer of line filters, surge protectors, and more, temporarily suspended taking new orders while it reorganized the business in light of Koss's passing. Grammy-winning recording engineer Roger Nichols, amateur called KE4BDA, became a silent key on April 9 after a battle with pancreatic cancer. According to the ARRL letter, Nichols was 66. He was best known for his work with Steely Dan and was honored with 3 Grammy Awards. Finally, on April 13, just a few weeks after celebrating his 100th birthday, ham radio legend Leo Meyerson, call W0GFQ, ex-call W9GFQ, also became a silent key. Meyerson founded and ran World Radio Laboratories in Council Bluffs, Iowa, producing the Globe line of transmitters that were very popular among hams in the mid-20th century. CQ columnist Joe Eisenberg, call K9NEB, was a family friend of Meyerson's. He will share some reflections on the man who was also his personal ham radio mentor in his July Kit Building column. One more thought here. Morse messages on Mars. The next Mars rover now being built, named Curiosity, will apparently be taking Morse code with it to the Red Planet when it is launched this fall. The ARRL letter reports that the Planetary Society's Science and Technology Coordinator, Emily Lekdawala, reported on her blog that the pattern created by the rover's 6 wheels, quoting, are in a pattern of shorts, squares, and longer rectangles, almost like dots and dashes, Morse code, close quote. The patterns reportedly spell out JPL. The official function of these patterns is as visual odometry markers, which help observers visually determine how far the rover has traveled. Curiosity is scheduled for launch between November 25th and December 18th of this year, and for arrival on Mars sometime next August. Let's go now to Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by the editor Rich Moss in W2VU. He titles this one, That Special Feeling. Welcome to our first annual Take to the Field special. I'm really excited about this issue, our first special topic issue in several years, and the first in a new series of specials, looking at topics of particular interest to hams of the 20-teens, or whatever we end up calling this decade. Among the hottest of these topics right now, thanks in part to the availability of high-quality gear that is small and lightweight, is operating out there, away from our home stations, whether it's on foot, on a hiking path, with friends in a local park, or on the road passing our contacts in a contest. We picked June for our Take It to the Field special because the weather is great for heading outside, and of course because it's the month for Field Day, that annual ham radio tradition that's an equal parts contest, emergency preparedness exercise, public relations event, cook-off. It does print here, cook-off, folks, not cook-out, and outdoor social activity. But there's much more to taking it to the field than joining your club on Field Day. And our goal for this issue is to paint a picture of the many different ways in which hams all over are getting out of their houses and taking their ham gear with them. I hope you'll agree that we succeeded. From the front cover, with Bob Curry, KC3VO, riding off into the sunset with his motorcycle mobile kilowatt station, to NW7US's propagation column in the back of the book, we take you all over the world of ham radio way from home. From the shores of Long Island Sound to the skies of Guanito, Mexico, and the earthquake-shattered streets of Christchurch, New Zealand, this issue is crammed full of articles showing hams having fun and helping their communities while operating in the field. We've got stories on makeshift stations on an island, a radio club that does high-altitude ham radio balloon launches, and community outreach with its digital mobile library, and a group of hams in Arizona that loves to head out to the park and play with antennas, even loading up metal lawn chairs and pizza pans. Plus, we have a review of three portable single-lever keyer pads for sending Morse code from who knows where, two looks at different kits for portable operating, tips on being prepared for just about anything in the field, rover operating in VHF contests, upcoming de-expeditions, and a guide to likely propagation conditions for Field Day. In fact, we have so many good stories that we couldn't fit them all in the issue. So we added a special web supplement with two more features. A project article on a battery discharge meter to let you know which power packs are ready for field use. And a look at a ham fest just for RVers in the middle of the Arizona desert. Our web supplement also contains expanded results of the 2010 CQDX Marathon and overflow from our Kids Corner, Public Service, and QRP columns. Be sure to check out that web supplement to get the maximum value from this special issue. I must admit that when we started gathering articles for this issue, I was a little concerned. Would we be able to get the word out in time to get a broad selection of articles on a wide array of outdoor activities? I needn't have worried. At least half of the articles that landed on my desk over the past few months had some outdoor connection. So I think we hit on exactly the right topic at exactly the right time. We've got three more special topic issues planned over the coming months, and we're starting to collect articles for them now. Here are the topics. Public service, that's this coming October, looking at different ways in which hams are continuing to innovate in providing emergency and public service communications. Cutting Edge, that's November, exploring how hams are continuing to contribute to the advancement of the radio art. And QRP, next April, the lure of low power operating is stronger today than ever, and we want to help you succeed if you decide to give it a try. Plus, we'll be looking at articles on new twists and ideas for experienced QRPers. In each special, it is our goal to include a mix of operating and technical articles to give readers a taste of the broad spectrum of available activities and projects within each specialty area. So if you've got a story that you think might fit in, please send it along. But please check out our writer's guidelines first. They're on our website. One other quick item before I let you loose on our Take It to the Field articles. We've had more than our usual number of letters this year from readers who can't quite figure out whether to believe what Professor Hyseloff wrote in his April article. All we can say is that the professor has been outstanding in the field for years and comes inside just frequently enough to write an article for our April issue each year. Now, I don't nominally do this, but if you're one of the readers we heard from who is upset about this article, I recommend that you read the op-ed in the May issue of QSD. Yes, QSD. It's on page 97, entitled The Serious Business of Ham Humor. What the author says about that magazine's humor writers applies equally to those who have graced our pages over the years, from Hasselfisti Scratchy and Schnorlock Ohms to Dr. Jerzy Ostermund-Tour and his protege, Professor Emil Hyseloff. The author of that op-ed is Eric Nichols, called KL7AJ, who, coincidentally, has written a book that we are publishing called The Opus of Amateur Radio Knowledge and Lore, a lighthearted look at just about everything about ham radio. It should be available by the time you read this. I hope you enjoy this Take It to the Field special, and then take it to the field yourself. Whether you're hiking, biking, or RVing, operating from a vacation spot or in the middle of the woods somewhere, or just joining your club for field day, make sure ham radio is part of your outdoor action this year. We hope this issue will inspire you to get out and get on the air. 73 Rich, W2VU. I have a few announcements for the month of June. Getting right to it, call K3DN, Kilo 3 Delta, November. Warminster Amateur Radio Club at the Union League in Philadelphia to honor the American flag. That's 1700 Zulu June 4 to 1700 Zulu Zune 5. NB9QV, November Bravo 9 Quebec Victor, from World War II submarine USS Kobe, and the annual Museum Ships Afloat Weekend, Manitowoc, Wisconsin, also June 4 and 5, from 1400 to 2100 Zulu. Special amateur call W0S, Whiskey Zero Sierra, from 150th anniversary of the starting of military newspaper Stars and Stripes, the Bothell Amateur Radio Club, June 10th and June 11th. A special event call from Canada, Victor Echo 3 MIS, VE3 MIS, from annual Streetsville Bread and Honey Festival, Mississauga, Ontario, Canada, June 4th and 5th. The following are HamFests that are scheduled for June. On June 10 and 11, HamCom, Plano Center, Plano, Texas. On June 11, Knoxville HamFest and Electronics Exposition in ARRL Tennessee State Conventions. That's at the Curbella Temple, Knoxville, Tennessee. On June the 12th, the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club HamFest, New York. Hall of Science Parking Lot, Flushing Meadows, Corona Park, Queens, New York. On June 18, Raritan Valley Radio Club ARRL Hamfest, Piscataqua High School, Piscataqua, New Jersey. And on June 20th, up here in good old Massachusetts, FLEA at MIT, Cambridge, Massachusetts. And on June 24th through 26th, Friedrichshafen Ham Radio Conference, Lake Constance, Friedrichshafen, Germany. Folks, you'll recall a few minutes ago, at the very introduction of this June 2011 CQ Magazine Digest reading, there was a lot of conversation about taking it to the field. Well, they have that special they were talking about. De-expedition, quote, yes, you can, close quote. By Ronald S. Boucher, B-O-U-C-H-E-R. Ron's call is KC2-S-O-U. Wow, a de-expedition. That would be a lot of fun. I wish I could do one, you say. Can we put one together on a small budget, I wonder? How many contacts can we make? Salt water ground? Well, maybe you can, at least a mini de-expedition. I've been a member of the Nutley, New Jersey Amateur Radio Society, W2GLQ, for about 3 years. In those years, we have had an increased membership of new and younger hams. As a club, we wanted to do more than just field day. At one of our meetings, Richard Cotiani, KC2LSD, remarked that he had had the experience of his life when he went down to Bogota, Colombia, and had a chance to operate on Gogona Island, IOTA Island on the Air, SA017, with his buddy Pedro Alaina, HK3JJH. As Cody was telling us about his wonderful experience, he made it so appealing that we as a club wanted to operate on an IOTA as well. Several of us said we would love to try, time permitting. So Cody went to work trying to find IOTA around the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut tri-state area. After much research, he came across IOTA NA136, Sheffield Island, Connecticut. Now here is the kicker, lighthouses. One is on Sheffield proper, ARLHS USA 753, and two more are visible from the island, Green's Ledge and Eaton's Neck lighthouses, across Long Island Sound in New York State. To top this off, the boat launch was only 63 miles away from home. To sum it up, we had an IOTA and three lighthouses. This was like hitting the pick four lottery. Okay, now how do you make this happen? Cody found out that there is a park on the island, so it is open to the public. That led him to the island's executive director, Susan Schneider. Cody called Ms. Schneider and told her we would like to operate from the island for the weekend. She did not see a problem, except that we could not stay overnight. We would have to leave at sundown and come back the next day. He asked if he could meet with her and make all the arrangements, and she agreed. Cody and Dave Kahlo, KD2C, vice president of our station, W2GLQ, drove up the Norwalk and met with Susan and her staff, who could not have been more helpful. After confirming that there would be a generator power on the island, Cody and Dave reserved the dates of July 17, 18, 2010, and agreed to the fees for the boat transport. Cody picked this date because there would be no major HF contest on that weekend. The following weekend was an IOTA contest, but he figured it would be better to be one of the few IOTA stations on the air that weekend than to compete with the big guns the following weekend. We called our club insurance agent to make sure we were covered, and I made reservations with the hotel. Now, the paperwork was just about done, but the hard part was just beginning. Because of all the logistics of getting to the island, we wanted to travel as light as possible, but still have solid stations. As emergency communication stations, we should have a go bag ready at all times, and this was a perfect opportunity to use mine. So, what equipment to bring? And what brands? Well, due to scheduling conflicts and the economy, there were only three members starting off. Anthony, Tony Testa, Cody, and me. One other operator, Frank Levin, said he could come for a day on Saturday. With a small but dedicated team, we decided to go with just two bands, 20 and 40 meters. This was our best bet for daytime worldwide contacts with the lack of sunspot activity. Now, please keep in mind, folks, that you are reading this in 20 minutes, but the trip involved 9 months of planning. Be advised, plan early and practice your setup. Now off to Sheffield Island. We left on Friday afternoon, and it took 2.5 hours in traffic to get to the hotel. After unpacking, we set out for our chores and food. We met with Susan and Captain Mark for last-minute details, and we all agreed to a 7 a.m. departure for the island on Saturday. It would take us approximately 35 minutes to get there. By the time we got back to the hotel, it was 11 p.m. This was my first expedition, so sleep was not easy to come by. We woke up at 5:30 a.m. and after breakfast and loading the boat, we were on our way. I am 39 years old, and I must tell you, being a fairly new ham, I was like a kid in a candy store. We got to the island around 8 a.m. and went straight into setup mode. I brought a 20-meter dipole with a 30-foot portable mask, and Cody went with his 40-meter home brewed 33-foot quarter-way vertical, which he had up in 20 minutes. Tony and I got the portable mast and dipole up, and approximately 9:30 a.m. we were on the air with a Yaesu FT-897D on 20 and a Nikon IC-706MK11G on 40. I started out on 20 on the IOTA calling frequency. After my second CQ, the contacts started, and after two or three Qs, the pileups began. Again, I am fairly new at hamming, so pileups like this were a little intimidating, but Tony and Cody are more experienced, and they helped me to handle them. We knew it was going to be a good weekend when, after 2 hours on the air, we had over 100 QSOs on 20 meters. I wish I could say that 20 was strong all weekend, but I'll get to that later. 40 meters was not good to start with. I know some of you are thinking that 40 is a nighttime band, but we wanted to give some local states a chance before the band went long. After Saturday afternoon, our club president, Frank, KC2AUP, arrived on the island, and he was having a ball out on 20 meters. With four operators, we could take a break every 2 hours or so, and believe me, we needed them. That afternoon was unforgettable. It was close to 100 degrees on the mainland, but on the island, with a nice breeze off the water, it was a little cooler. We had prepared a cooler with sport drinks and cold cuts to keep us going for the weekend. Now, there is one thing that is mandatory for this crew of hams, if not most, coffee. I made sure I got myself a cheap coffee pot for the trip, and when you heard the generator putting in some overtime, you knew the coffee pot was on. Something that became clear to us was that there were just as many stations looking for the lighthouses as the IOTA contact, and we were activating three lighthouses, as all were in view of our station. That evening we shut down around 8 p.m., packed away the radios, and put them inside the staff house. We were able to keep the antennas up for the night, so that was a great time saver. We counted over 400 QSOs on 20 meters and 125 on 40 as we were waiting for the boat to leave. The talk became making 1,000 QSOs before this trip was over. We got back to Sheffield Island and were on the air by 8:30 a.m. the next day, and soon the pilots were back as well. I was working the best I could. I finished one QSO called QRZ, and in the pile of stations I heard a Juliet Hotel. Juliet Hotel, make a call. The response was Juliet Hotel 4, Italy Foxtrot Foxtrot. Wow, my first Japan contact ever. The morning and afternoon were going well. We had steady contacts, but of course, out of nowhere, the band just went blank. I was calling QRZ, 250 stations, but on the next call heard just a few crickets. Those were some funky band conditions. It was so bad, we checked to see if the antenna was still up. It was, so we broke for lunch and some coffee. We had 800-plus QSOs in the log, but now the bands were really hurting. But now the bands were really hurting us big time. We wanted to reach our 1,000 QSO goal, but it was not looking good. We needed nearly 200 more contacts, but we did not give up. The rest of the afternoon, the band was up and down. We needed to pack up by 7:30 p.m., so radios were going off by 7 p.m. We all know Great Line is the time to operate, and this day was no exception. By 5 p.m., we needed only 75 more QSOs to reach our goal. Would we make the 1,000 QSOs? By 6 p.m., we were so close. Now Great Line took full effect. It was like all of Europe was calling. At 7 p.m., I gave my last RST report and thanked all the stations for their time and signaled W2GLQ from NA136QRT. Wow, it was over. We checked our logs for the weekend with the two stations. We worked 49 states, 58 DX entities, and a grand total of 1,024 QSOs. We had achieved our goal. I'd like to thank Cody, KC2LSD, and Tony, KG2GL, for taking me under their wings with my first DX expedition. My fellow hams, the main thing I want you to get out of this story is just get out there and play radio. Now, folks, I'll conclude the commentary with a little explanation about lighthouses and amateur radio. The Amateur Radio Lighthouse Society, the acronym is ARLHS, sponsors a program whose goal is not only to promote amateur radio, but lighthouses and the keepers who run them as well. There are over 10,000 lights worldwide, each having its own identification number. Hams may qualify for certificates by contacting other ham stations operating at or near different lighthouses, and activating a lighthouse has become a fun in the field activity. Now, here's the catch to achieving qualified lights. There are rules that govern activation. To keep it short, we will look at two of the rules. First is the 1,000-meter rule. If you operate within 1,000 meters of a qualified light, it is a valid activation. Of course, operating on the light property is preferred, but it is not always possible because many lighthouses are not open to the public. Second is the visual sight rule. If in the opinion of the operator, an operator with the 1,000-meter rule would be illegal, ill-advised, impossible, or impractical, the rule is suspended, and the visual sight rule can be invoked. The visual sight rule states that an operation is valid if a station is within visual sight of the physical structure of the light during the day. For more information on the rules and the list of lights, go to www.arlhs.com. And there is a similar list in Europe that sponsors amateur radio lighthouse activities there. Each group runs, sometimes overlapping, lighthouse weeks or weekends in the summertime. Enjoy yourself. It's a great new experience. I have here the results of the 2010 CQDX Marathon. The author is John Sweeney, K9EL/VA3CDX. It's very lengthy, and of course, as always, CQ Magazine does a great job of compiling all of the information and listing it for any of those that are seriously involved in seeing where the standings are by top score, single mode, or whatever. So it begins on page 28. I'll just give you a little bit of the introduction on that one. Participation in the 2010 CQDX Marathon was up significantly, despite some of the worst band conditions in years. Excluding the new PJ countries, that's down in the Caribbean, there were actually two fewer countries available compared to the year 2009. However, there were 58 countries with no activity at all in 2010. Overall, not the best year for DXing, so the competition was as fierce as ever. There were significantly more people with higher scores, so those countries that were active were in penny logs. In the end, taking into account the new PJ countries, the winning 2010 score in the unlimited class was identical to the winning 2009 score. Logs were received from 62 countries and 28 zones, a nearly 30% increase over last year. Once again, the majority of the logs, that's 75%, were unlimited class. 60% of the logs came from three countries, United States of America, Brazil, and England, with participation from England up over 100% from 2009. We even had one SWL, shortwave listener, entry this year. The competition for certificates was especially exciting in 2010, as there was a 25% increase in the number of single-mode submissions and a 50% increase in QRP, that's 10 watts or less, submissions. As the DX Marathon rules were not clear on multiple entries and multiple certificates, a clarification was published earlier this year. And the winners are, once again, Bob Locher, L-O-C-H-E-R, call W9KNI, that's an American call sign, was the top scorer in the unlimited class with a score of 325. Bob worked 285 of the 291 countries that were available in 2010, as well as all 40 CQ zones. Congratulations to Bob on winning 2 years in a row. PP5EG, OM3EY, and N0FW were not far behind with scores of 323, 320, and 318, respectively. Bob's first new one was worked at 2200 Zulu on December 31st, so he obviously was very active right to the end of the contest. Competition in formula class was just as competitive, with Bernard Wittek, W-I-T-T-E-K, call DL4CW, claimed the formula class plaque with a total score of 254, 4 points ahead of the runner-up K0ABC. Congratulations to all our formula class participants. Once again, the plaques for the winners of both classes will be provided by the Northern Illinois DX Association. We sincerely appreciate their support for sponsoring the DX Marathon plaques. And folks, again, in summary, if you're one of those that are interested in the absolute results because you might have participated yourself, the article begins on page 28 of CQ4, June 2011, and concludes on page 33, between photographs and some commercial material. As I turn the pages, I would be remiss in not giving you this announcement, talking about contests. The 2011 CQ Worldwide VHF Contest. It starts 1800 UTC, Saturday, July 16, 2011, and it ends 2100 UTC, Sunday, July 17, 2011. There's a special note here that this year's rules reflect significant changes, so if you're into that, please read them carefully. All the information about that begins on page 38 of CQ. And as I said, to repeat myself, there are significant changes and quite a few rules besides just following them, so you do have to play the game fairly by knowing what goes where and with whom and how, I guess you could put it. If you need help looking it up or reading it, it's on page 38 and following. Now, for those of you who like to go to Hamfest, that's like ham radio flea markets, the Huntsville Hamfest, and the American Radio Relay League Alabama Section Convention is going to be August 20th and 21st of 2011. It'll be at the Von Braun Center in Huntsville, Alabama. The program highlights for that, featuring a huge new equipment dealer show, many major manufacturers, giant flea market, and more. There'll be an international DX contest, technical and public service forums. So if you're down there in the South and are trying to get into ham radio or are really wondering what it's all about, anybody can attend. So have a good time on August 20th and 21st at the Von Braun Center in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Huntsville Hemp Fest and ARRL Alabama Section Convention. Let's get back to taking it to the field specials, taking it to the woods. QRP by Cam Hartford, call N6GA. Whether you're off to the woods, the beach, the trail, the vacation cabin, or the campground, don't forget to pack a QRP rig. Now, folks, QRP rigs are very low-power rigs, less than 10 watts output. Doing a GORK, an SOTA, an AT, a top of the world, or just taking the goats out for a hike. Even I don't know what all those letters stand for all the time, folks, sorry. A QRP rig makes a great companion. Operating in milliwatt field day, QRP F-field, QRP in the field, FYBO, BUBBA, or the Bubble B. These are operating events intended to take advantage of the portability and versatility of today's QRP radios. What drives so many of us to participate in these events? It's fun, plain and simple. For some of us, they offer new reasons to get ourselves outside and to hike a trail. For others who get out regularly, they provide a reason to build new radios. Yet for others, the thrill comes from operating a radio in an environment different from the everyday one, using different equipment and antennas. Hike to operate, build to hike. It's a clear-cut case of the chicken versus the egg. It's easy to carry something small and lightweight, so there's a need for this kind of radio. Since there are small, lightweight, competent radios available, we can easily get one and take it on a hike, do field day with it, or take it on a vacation. No matter, though, as QRP rigs and portable operating were made for each other. One afternoon at 20 meters, CW, that's Morse code, I responded to a station calling CQ in the QRP section of the band. It was Jim Clewitt, W1PID. When Jim and I completed our queue, so I was immediately called by Hans Bosch, W1JSB. I had occasionally seen posts by Jim and QRPL regarding their outings together, but hadn't paid close attention. This time I dialed up Jim's web page. For more information about their operations, Jim and Hans make regular treks in the outdoors and do an excellent job of documenting them. On their webpage, I counted more than 50 hikes, bike trips, ski trips, and boat outings. The photographs they take along the way make a person understand why they get out as often as they do. Jim documents each trip with details about the location, weather, what antennas and gears they used, and what contacts were made. Now, for the listener again, the author goes on in significant detail about the rigs, the tuners, antennas, and other equipment that is easy to carry around or put together quickly or take down easily. But in summarization, the concept of the trail-friendly radio grew out of the need for a small portable radio that could easily be transported to and operated from a place of a few creature comforts. By this we mean sitting on a log, a rock, on the ground. No table, no chair, no operating position with transceiver, computer, uninterruptible power supply, liquid refreshments, and climate control. Just the great outdoors with its less than comfortable seating arrangements. The idea pertains to both the physical layout of the radio, its controls and connectors and readouts, if any, and the parts of the radio. A standard box-shaped radio with the controls on the front and connectors on the back is not very convenient to operate from such a location. So here the author and the participants show a very significant kit that was built to accommodate it for better protection. Going on, say you've hauled your favorite K2 up to the mountaintop, K2 is a small radio, and found a shady tree trunk to lean against. Just think of that, huh, folks? With the radio sitting on the ground next to you, it's hard to see the controls or the frequency display. You could prop up the radio against something, but then it would be sitting on the cables with connectors coming out the back. Not good for the radio. Hence the idea for the trail-friendly radio. As TRFs evolved, the controls and readouts migrated flounder-like to the top of the box where they were more easily seen and accessed. This allowed the box to become flatter, a subtle change which lent some stability for operation on uneven surfaces. So folks, if your interest is piqued, the author goes on to list 4 specific radios that could very well suit your purposes, even if you have to modify them in different cartons or containers to make them safer to use. First is the Elcraft KX1, the Hendrix PFR3, ATS4 by the Call KD1JV, and the Tentec R4020. Now moving down the trail, it's now time to stop riding and start hiking. The sun is shining, so I feel a strong pull to grab a rig and head out. There's a local lump named Potato Mountain that needs to be hiked and activated. 72-73 cam, call, and 6GA. I'll change pace now and get right to the chemistry. Getting the Right Chemistry, that is. That's the title of the article in Kids Corner by Brittany Decker called KB1-OGL. Most high school kids shudder at the mention of the word chemistry. However, as an organic chemistry student at my high school, I was assigned to visit a chemistry lab. A trip which would change my view on chemistry and on the way that other subjects often prejudged as boring, like amateur radio, should be taught. Last November, I had the privilege of going to Agamatrix Incorporated, a company that tests and modifies diabetic test strips. While this may sound like the most boring field trip I could ever go on, it has actually been one of the most memorable. The way that Richard Williams, the head of scientific development at Agamatrix, received and welcomed my presence was unexpected. He certainly did not get a lot of his own work done that day because for most of the 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. workday, he taught me the complex chemistry behind the strip. When I left Agamatrix that day, I left with a packet of printed paper that we had drawn structures and reactions on to help me understand how the strip works. No, the diabetic strip does not suck the blood into the meter itself, but it does use the energy from the blood to calculate its glucose concentration. Not only did I leave with a whole new understanding of the diabetic strip and meter and the chemistry behind it, but Richard also gave me some new ideas for a chemistry project that I have been working on that is based on the work of another amateur radio operator named John Canzius, K3TUP. John is now a silent key. My day at Agamatrix taught me that any subject can be made interesting, but it is up to the teacher to exude his or her love for the subject to the patient. At Agamatrix Incorporated, the main research is testing the diabetic strips and meters that are produced by the company. There are a few departments involved in this. There is the quality control lab that does all of the meticulous testing, about 2 million strips per day. It takes a full staff of people to do all of the testing. After meeting various people in different departments, I sat down with Richard to learn the complex theory behind the chemistry that goes on in the test strip. The strip, a piece of plastic about an inch and a half long and familiar to virtually anyone with diabetes, is actually plastic surrounding a strip of paper coated with a soap-like chemical. This chemical helps the liquid, the blood, quickly saturate the paper inside of the strip, where there are organic chemicals that react with it and give the glucose reading. When the blood comes into contact with these organic chemicals, they act as catalysts to the glucose molecules within the blood. Each individual glucose molecule will go through a number of steps to reach the final result. Along the way, what starts out as a chemical process becomes an electronic one. The bridge from chemistry to electronics is made at the end of the strip, where the electrons that are collected through chemical reactions are carried to an electrode and then measured to determine the concentration of glucose in the blood. When I came back from lunch, Richard set up a small experiment for me to do. The experiment consists of me testing 160 strips for readings. I would be testing out of 4 packs of strips, 2 of which had been put in an oven inside of a beaker with water droplets inside and an evaporating dish on top at 50 degrees Celsius, that's 122 degrees Fahrenheit, for 10 hours. I used a standard scientific method and formulated the typical components of the lab report. While working out the math and conversions, Richard saw the way I did my math, fraction bars to keep my units straight, and was very surprised that a high school student could make those conversions so easily and accurately. He had never seen that method before, and said he'd have to keep it in mind for his own use. The field trip, although exhausting at the end of the day, was exciting for me. It was definitely a day well spent. Richard Williams and his exuberance and love of chemistry had captivated me and gotten me to strive to understand the chemistry they work with every day. Not only was it what I had hoped for, but Richard had exceeded my expectations by taking so much time out of his workday to explain principles and draw diagrams that he said he hardly thought of anymore. He said I brought back memories of Fisher and the framework diagrams that he had to look in his old textbooks from college to remember how to draw. Now here's the connection to ham radio. After I went on this field trip and learned so much about chemistry in one day, I immediately thought about writing about my experience in Kids Corner, quite simply because it serves as an example of the way every amateur radio operator should behave towards the younger generation. Chemistry, a topic many kids do not even want to talk about, is much like amateur radio in that it can be an exciting and rewarding experience with the right teacher. People who approach teaching students with exuberance and love for their subject will captivate the students and imbue them with their own passion for the subject. I consider every amateur radio operator an Elmer, that's like a helper, mainly because every single operator is a representative of this hobby. We are all advocates for amateur radio, and the way we behave as individuals will shape other people's opinions of amateur radio. If the only radio operator a person has met are bitter and antisocial, the person will generalize all amateur radio operators as being that way. Having a bright outlook on the future of amateur radio also goes a long way. No one wants to be part of a hobby that is dying. Amateur radio is not dying at all. It is just looking for people like Richard Williams, those who are passionate, personable, and persistent teachers. 73, Brittany, KB, 1, OG. And folks, I'll close with a footnote to Brittany's articles. John Kanzius, K-A-N-Z-I-U-S, whose amateur call was K3TUP, was profiled in the January 2009 issue of CQ. Shortly before he became a silent key, he passed away. He is a 2008 inductee into the CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame. He developed a still experimental method of using radio waves to kill cancer cells while leaving healthy cells around them undamaged. Work on his process continues. Ladies and gentlemen, this brings me just about up to time for this month's reading of CQ Magazine in digest format. This month, we've been reading the June 2011 issue. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. And our website, a very fine one indeed, updated every single day with a great deal of information about amateur radio. www.handyham.org. My name is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're located about 50 miles south of Boston, right on Buzzards Bay, the gateway to Cape Cod. Incidentally, I seldom mention this, but I'm only too pleased to do so. If any of you have internet capabilities and you'd like to drop me an email making some suggestions or recommendations or constructive criticisms, you can drop me an email at my call sign, which is n1blf@comcast.net. 73. Have a great summer.